What I want to do is talk about a number of things, but before I do, I wanted to do two disclaimers for you. Number one, if there are errors or oversights in this presentation, they're probably due to me, and if there's anything of consequence and value, and it's probably due to my co-author, so take that into account. What we want to do is give an overview of some of the charges and what this particular work group is focusing on, and then move on to some examples of current projects, and then basically a call for help. I want to start with this thought. We really need to be talking about, and I propose we redefine this term in this way, called gypsum, because it is not just that. It's a variety of other things, and many have spoken to that, especially this morning, very eloquently. I don't want to belabor it other than to say that just for expediency's sake, we are using gypsum as just a short version so we can move along. But I think it's absolutely critical what was said this morning be taken to heart, which is this is not the end of the story. And gypsum in and of itself, while it may have some unique properties, you just simply cannot ignore the other salts and materials that are co-occurring with it and interact with it and modify it. And I won't go into any more detail because it was handled well this morning. One charge we have as a group is to investigate the relationships of the forms of gypsum, the landforms, and across the landscapes. Basically, what is it? I don't want to go into that either too much because there was a good presentation this morning by Doug Wysocki about attempts to try to develop a common language. And I would ask patience of those who have their own pet terminology that differs from what you've heard and seen to move forward and engage the rest of the community and us in particular so that we develop a common language, because it's absolutely critical that we all understand what it is each other are looking at and talking about. And it may seem mundane, but it's actually at the core of what we're going to be involved with, especially as this moves out into working with more and more people. So language is important. We are also trying to investigate and document occurrence of gypsum on landforms and across landscapes. The where. There's some really good examples this morning and earlier about some examples of that, but for the most part we're still in a compiling stage and trying to understand. This is an example of a L-core soil, very shallow soil we saw that Lynn Loomis talked about this morning. And this one happens to occur on a structural bench. Well, where else does it occur? You can see in the background that some escarpments, they're erosional escarpments and outliers that occur in rounded hills where the soil tends to recur. And we'll see that again a little later in a inference model projection. But we're trying to understand that across the board. Make the combination, the linkage between different forms of gypsum and associated materials in different locations across the landscape. We suspect that there are differences and we can track those. We're also investigating the pedogenic and geomorphic transport processes of gypsum, which is the when and the how. All right. Good example, we saw this earlier, this image well, at White Sands. The haze along the mountain there is not a haze, it's aeolian detrital material being eroded, transported, and then deposited along in front of you. So that geomorphic processes in the classical sense are very much active, and Dr. Horton described that a little bit earlier, and that's quite right. We have that issue, that side of it, to deal with, and we will hope to do that. And if I have time at the end of my talk, I want to give a couple of quick examples of what we're thinking about. And even lacustrine alternatives here can show up. We're also charged with identifying and documenting relationships of gypsum dissolution and ground subsidence. That's what the previous speaker was carried on at some length about. But those examples are not the only ones. Here's a rehash of this map, but I tweaked it a little bit because I wanted to call out with red some of the subsidence areas of potential karst and that aspect of it. There's a really good example here, I think, from West Texas, where you can see a number of features, karstic features, that are very striking. One of them is, and get the mouse to work, you can see the dimpled pattern across the landscape of sinkholes, dolines, that are very extensive. And you can also see a lot of lineation trends in that area following joint sets within the bedrock, the gypsum bedrock. And they demark a number of very interesting structures. One of them are these remnant low plateau areas, these rectangular zones that are slightly elevated. And more interesting, these collapse troughs, which are sort of karstic analogs to Horst and Graben. They're very much not tectonic features, but they certainly do control the local landscape in many profound ways. So karst is one of those geomorphic processes, and we'll talk about others if there's time at the end. We're also investigating the relationship of gypsum to other salts and materials. I'll only say that we do know that these things do co-occur, and the soil patterns reflect that, like this. This is a sodium-affected barren area within a gypsum-rich soil out in the Tularosa Basin. And there's no apparent difference in elevation across there that's perceptible to us, but obviously there's a hydrologic difference or something that's giving rise to those concentrated bare areas. So what is it that we can determine and convey in terms of concepts and models, predictive or conceptual, that explain those patterns? And then we want to identify and compare models of gypsum with patterns and processes in current soil survey areas. And this is where the rubber hits the road for some of this work, is the application. And that boils down to both conceptual models, which is more conventional, and predictive models. On the conceptual side, this is a picture we saw earlier, but it's a good one, about the eruptive blisters, or there's analogs called tumuli that some people, in particular in the Middle East, have talked about. And Dr. Hunnell talked about this morning. And the point I was trying to get to is this: you know, how do we begin to try to capture and project some explanation of how these things come to be? And this is just a draft. There's nothing sacred about it by any stretch. And it's a composite of a variety of features we see. Here's one of those blisters or tumuli that you see. And it's bounded by these very hard mineral crust or fragments. But in the core, there's a much finer gypsum powder. Not only that, but in between these little microhighs, you have typically a microbiotic crust, and then oftentimes immediately under it, some sort of this vertical structured material of the gypsum. Here we're calling it honeycomb gypsum. I'm not sure we've settled on a term for it, but the idea is that it's something quite different in terms of its morphology. There are also these hardened blocks of material. We're not sure if how they relate to these hard, very hard mineral crusts around the tumuli. It may be part of a related sequence. There's also continuous petrogypsic zones, oftentimes underlain by intermittent petrogypsic zones at depth. And the vertical lines here are trying to indicate and convey the polygonal structure that Dr. Hundle mentioned. Very critical in terms of conveying how the stress dynamics of the material behaves, and also preferential flow paths for water, and in some cases, root exploitation of the material. So anyway, the bottom line is the details don't matter so much as it is an attempt to convey a collection of ideas, of observations, of morphology, of field conditions, and we are a field science at its heart and core. So we're trying to work on that. Now, what about, those are the charges and some examples of them. The current projects that we have underway are kind of a potpourri, but many of them focus on two major surveys that are going on in gypsy areas that have been talked about here today. But it's not limited to that. In fact, it's something we all know, but we better not forget, which is that there's a much larger area of real estate that is affected by low to moderate gypsum contents. And although the conversation is focusing on gypseous materials, the high-end stuff, there's a lot more ground in the western U.S. that's affected by the mid to low-range stuff. So those needs are real time, and it's driving much of this investigation and curiosity. We're also trying to develop models about gypsum and soluble salt contents and distribution across the landscapes. I mentioned that before, but in this case I want to move on in a minute from not the conceptual model cartoon things we've just talked about, but rather move on to an inference model example. And last item here is the GPR EMI field investigations that have been showing some real surprising and substantive progress and promise. So I'm going to talk about these last two items here, kind of back to back. This is an inference model example from part of a quadrangle down in Culberson County, Texas, and it was used to generate both a topographic presentation of the landscape and then merge it with some projection of the distribution of likely distribution of soil bodies out there. And just as a case in point, I showed that slide of the L-core soil right at the start, the real thin one. And that is in yellow on this image. And you can see that in this inference model, it predicts that it would occur, tend to be occurring or expected to occur on escarpments. And so we see the tie in between field observation and tacit knowledge being caught and captured and projected in some sort of predictive model to try to speed the mapping process. Okay, what about the GPR and the EMI portion of this? Well, a couple of quick findings are here, and I'll try to show you some examples that these folks have come up with, and it's pretty promising. This GPR traverse shows two areas of Picorni soil which has had very strong petrogypsic horizon in it. But there's this gap in between of something else. So GPR surprisingly is able to get through these materials, and much given its usual limitations in salt-rich environments, it's showing some real promise. So we have some tools to get out and look for things. This is one we saw earlier. I'll move on to this one, which provides us with an attempt to interpret the depth to gypsum bedrock. How deep is the soil? The green line has been traced in to show some sense of the variation of the soil depth across this unit. And here's an EMI set of information to try to show differences in some of the conductivity, electrical conductivity of the soil. So these tools are providing us some mechanisms for actually testing some of these ideas, and progress is being made, and that's kind of encouraging. What about the hydraulic properties? Well, I guess it boils down to trying to understand it in several different contexts. One of them is, what about the conventional parameters that we typically are interested in and then use for interpretive extrapolation? The other one is in a more broad ecosystem function, which is the hydropodology side of it. Well, on the hydraulic property side of it, we've been doing some in-situ KSAT measurements out in White Sands, and there have been questions raised about the value or the efficacy of using apparent field texture. And that's a fair question. Does it mean anything or not? Well, it's difficult to constrain, and so we've always traditionally preferred having particle size analysis in the laboratory and that sort of thing, which we can't do at the present time for gypsum and such. But the field studies are showing that the KSAT is very much inconsistent in line with the course of the material, the faster the flow rates, as one would expect, and in the ranges that you'd normally expect. So apparent field texture has some value. Now this is, well, we'll just skip past this one. Never mind. I didn't realize it would white out on us so bad. Okay, a couple of side elaborations since I have time. In high gypsum soils and in arid environments, these hypergypsic materials can function primarily as detrital material. And I think that's a pretty big deal. Most of us don't traditionally think of it in its ability to be moved and shuttled around. We usually think of it in terms of being something in solution and then precipitated and shuttled around that way. So those are kind of the two big arenas. And a couple of quick examples of what we mean by this in terms of classical geomorphic processes and detrital material. Aeolian examples occur not only in White Sands, but here's an example of some of these stabilized dunes that Curtis Munger mentioned earlier today. You have examples of alluvial gypsum. You can see very well the alluvial stratification down here in the base in this profile, in this Matador soil. This is alluvium. It's in a drainage way. It's being shuttled around primarily as detrital material. So, but it doesn't stop there. We also have, there are mass movement examples of this, but I think in most of the areas that we're looking at, it's more like hill slope processes and residuum. You do have gypsum residuum and hill slope sediment modestly being transported, or at least broken down, over hard bedrock. And there's an example in the sidewall of this of Cottonwood Creek drainage way in Culberson County. So when you get to the low to moderate gypsum range, you're shifting over away from the detrital aspects and moving more into, predominantly those things affected by water, dissolution, reprecipitation. And one example of that you might think of in terms of both vertical and lateral chromatography. if you want to think of it that way. Jimmy Richardson mentioned this the other day in his talk in minerals, soil minerals and across landscapes in that symposium, and it touches on the idea that in recharge sites you may well have a sequence where you have vertical infiltration, downward flow. You may typically expect to find a sequence of carbonates coming out first, followed by gypsum, followed by salts. And in discharge sites, you may find at least the potential for just the opposite. So we can begin to put these ideas together so that we can begin to explain the patterns of materials we see in soil profiles and across landscapes and make some sense out of it, as well as increase our predictive capabilities. So lastly, I would simply ask, participate, enrich the dialogue. This is a very fertile time and a fluid time for these ideas, and you can have a large impact.